All right, our topic for tonight will be the religious leaders in American Jewry in the early to mid-19th century. Before we get to the leading figures, I want to discuss just for a few minutes the emergence of the second synagogue in New York, B'nai Jeshurun. It's an important topic because in the colonial period, when there are very few Jews in America, if a Jew has a strong religious opinion, they might disagree with the existing kehillah, but there's very little they can do about it because there's insufficient number of Jews to make a breakaway synagogue. There's no critical mass. It's only when you have enough numbers to work with that you can successfully create a second synagogue and sustain it. The first city to do that was Philadelphia. We mentioned that last week, that Rodev Shalom was a breakaway from Mikveh Israel. But in New York, it happened in 1825. B'nai Jeshurun breaking away from Sherith Israel. Why did they do it? What were the issues in play?
It was like about 130, 140 years, they had a monopoly.
So Sherith Israel, for a century and a half, had a monopoly on Jewish religious worship in New York. Why did that monopoly break down? Why the need for a second shul? So the official reason was anger over the irreligiosity of the membership of Sherith Israel and the inability of the leadership of Sherith Israel to crack down on gross violations of the halakha by their own leadership. And so the B'nai Jeshurun were, by comparison, more pious, and they wanted to have a shul where you had Sabbath observers and people who were scrupulously kosher, and certainly would not marry outside the faith. That's, yes?
Not necessarily Sephardic.
Okay. So on the surface, it was an issue of religiosity. But beneath the surface, there were two other factors. One was the desire by Ashkenazic Jews to pray in their own right, not in the Sephardic Spanish-Portuguese right.
But where did those Ashkenazic Jews come from?
So those Ashkenazic Jews came mostly from southern Germany and from Posen.
Early 1700s?
From all over, ranging from the early 1700s all the way to the 1820s. There had been accumulating over time a significant number of Ashkenazim in New York. In fact, the majority of Jews in New York at that point were Ashkenazim. So the ethnic issue plays a role. But the other is, you have a Sephardic or Spanish-Portuguese cultural elite that is indifferent to the needs of the newcomers, the recent arrivals, and who look down upon them as being social inferiors. So you have disgruntled German/Polish Jews who are a little bit more religious, less Americanized, and less wealthy than the Sherith Israel crowd, and they want their own shul, they want to run it their way. But it should be noted that even though they enacted various bylaws requiring a certain level of religious observance for seat holders and for office holders, eventually even B'nai Jeshurun will go the way of many of the American synagogues. As their clientele becomes more Americanized, they become less pious and less interested in preserving the old world ways, and more interested in being regarded by others as part of the social elite. So eventually, B'nai Jeshurun loses its standing as an Orthodox synagogue. This is after the Civil War. And many other synagogues that follow that are breakaways from them, Anshei Chesed, Shaarei Tzedek, eventually no longer are immigrant Orthodox synagogues. As their population becomes Americanized, they become a more liberal style of congregation. Sometimes very liberal, sometimes only a little bit liberal. What's the difference between going radical reform and effectively becoming a forerunner to conservative Judaism? Depending upon the shul, each one had its own story. Okay.
Well, the first one that became established as a synagogue reform was Temple Emmanuel.
All right, so we're going to get to that tonight. Tonight we're going to discuss that.
Every synagogue that came so-called reform or liberal was formerly Orthodox.
Well, there's one exception in Baltimore, Har Sinai Verein. So in the 1820s, you have the arrival of many Central European Jews to the United States. The Jewish population doubles between 1818 and 1826, from 3,000 to 6,000. Then it will quickly double again and double again, so that before the Civil War you have 150,000, and before the influx of Eastern European Jews you have 250,000. So this is a tremendous influx of Central European Jews. And they need religious leadership. But in the beginning, they don't have it. And to be honest, they might not really even want it. And that's, yeah.
What was the reason for such a large immigration? Were there problems in the homeland?
Yes. In 1819, you had riots in Germany, the Hep-Hep riots. You also had the slow progress of emancipation that disgruntled many Jews who thought that that the arrival of civil rights would happen much more quickly. There were discriminatory laws against Jews establishing families all over southern and central Germany that only the one child of a household could marry and settle roots in that community. So people were looking for a place to go. And just bad economic conditions in certain parts of the country. Also, after 1848, a failed revolution and a conservative backlash, which leads further to people looking to get out, especially if they had participated in the revolution.
Are we talking about the old guard of German Jews, or before
that? We're talking about, the question was about why German Jews are coming to America.
This is the period of the royal, the German Jews.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes. But they're not our crowd yet. They're still poor. All right. Now, in 1824, a young man comes to the United States named Isaac Leiser, Yitzchak Isaac Leiser. He comes from southern Germany and arrives in Richmond, Virginia. And he's a bookkeeper by trade for a few years in a family business. He had limited secular and Judaic education, formal education. By his own admission, he only learned Baba Metzia, Baba Basra, Beitza, and part of Chulin during his Judaic schooling. But nonetheless,
that's a lot.
By American day school standards, that's a lot. Okay. But he had a desire to learn and was very much self-taught, both in secular and Judaics. In 1824, he arrives on the scene. He volunteers to be the part-time chazan in the synagogue in Richmond. Now, bear in mind, he's a German Jew, and the synagogue is Sephardic. But that's okay. He can learn the Nusach, and he learns it very well. In 1829, there's an opening in Mikveh Israel at Philadelphia, which is one of the two most prestigious synagogues in the United States, together with Sherith Israel of New York. They need a chazan. Who are they going to hire? Well, there aren't very many capable candidates, and so Isaac Leiser puts his hat in the ring, and he wins the job. Despite the fact that he's an Ashkenazic Jew, this is a Sephardic congregation, he's not an ordained rabbi by any stretch, but he's a good choice, and the primary reason why he's a good choice is because he remains loyal to the traditional observances. Remember, Gustavus Poznanski was hired by Charleston thinking that he was a frum yid. And what happened to him? All of a sudden he was pushing for reforms of organs and abolishing second day Yom Tov. Every aveira they thought he wouldn't do, he did. But Leiser was a traditional Jew through and through. And he kept Mikveh Israel on the straight and narrow path of what might call orthodoxy. Well, Leiser has an agenda for American Judaism. He wants to educate American Jews in their own tradition. Because after all, the younger people, who were the product of the Spanish-Portuguese wave of immigration, had very little education in Judaics. They knew almost nothing. Hardly could they read Hebrew. And as for the German Jews, who were new arrivals, most of them were basically illiterate. If not illiterate, then they didn't know much of their religion other than folkloristic elements of the religion and basic levels, basic observances. But they had no real text knowledge. So what does Leiser do? He translates into English, first of all, some catechisms, we might call it, books about Judaism. Then he translates the Siddur, the Ashkenazic rite, not that he was using it in his shul, but for the Ashkenazic Jews to have English language prayer book. He translates the Chumash. That's his most important contribution, the Chamisha Chumashei Torah in five volumes. Later on, he would translate the entire Bible, the Leiser Bible, which I have a few copies of.
Where's
It was the standard Bible in American synagogues. Right, before JPS produced the 1917 volume, and before the Herz Chumash became popular, the Leizer Bible was very, very common in traditional Jewish homes, and even not-so-traditional Jewish homes. Okay. He establishes, in 1843, a periodical called The Occident and the American Israel Advocate. The Occident, as its name indicates, is the opposite of the Orient. So it's geared for westernized Jews, to give them something to read of middlebrow to high-caliber literature, articles about Jewish interest, translations of religious text. It's a high-quality publication that he published for 25 years, from 1843 until his death in 1868. You have to bear in mind that Jewish periodicals did not have much of a history at this point. In America, the only publication, serial publication that had previously existed was The Jew by Samuel Jackson. Now, Samuel Jackson was a New York Jew who was concerned about missionary activities, about the Society for the Ameliorating of the Jews, the civil condition of the Jews. These were Christian missionaries looking to harm the faith of Judaism. And so Jackson put out a periodical for 2 years fending off the missionaries. But it was not about general Jewish interest. It wasn't a newspaper in any sense. So the Occident of Leizer, really, other than Ludwig Philipson's Allgemeiner, starting in 1837 in Germany, it's the only real publication in the Jewish world that's consistently being put out, and it's a high-level publication.
What was the circulation?
I don't know, but it was widely distributed around the country. I couldn't tell you how many physical copies were sent, but it was not just in Philadelphia. It spread around the country so that Leizer's influence extended north, south, and to the west. Yeah.
You know, 1843 is no accident. The 13 German Jews founded my international order.
B'nai B'rith, correct. So B'nai B'rith is the first attempt at a fraternal order that is going to take in Jews who might not feel comfortable in the Masonic lodges that existed around the country, to which Jews might have been welcome, but would have felt uncomfortable, which we'll discuss in a moment when we get to Abraham Reis, the first rabbi. It was a newspaper slash journal of articles. It was a little bit of both.
You're talking about The Occident?
The Occident, yes.
Up until not long ago, the Jewish Week claimed lineage from there.
Yeah.
Many years ago, when they merged from the American Examiner into the Jewish Week, they used to, in the staff box,
I didn't know that.
The Yichus chart, going all the way back to the Jewish Messenger, and before that, The Occident.
So The Messenger was published in New York, was in the 1870s.
60s
and 70s, yeah. All right, so Leizer...
So was it a weekly?
It was a monthly. It was a monthly. Now, the other thing he does, in the late 1840s, he establishes a Jewish publication society. Now, this should come as a little bit of a surprise to you, because if you read any book published by the JPS, and you look at the insignia, what year does it say on the insignia? 1888. So not 1847 or 48. What happened? For 5 years, Leizer had this publication society, and he put out as much as he could, mostly of his own works, including Bible translations. But then there was a fire, and all the proofs burned to the ground. So he lost everything. He had invested heavily in it, and it was all gone. So the Jewish Publication Society that still exists today, the JPS, is a reincarnation of Leizer's JPS, but 4 decades later. Okay. Isaac Leizer believes in Jewish unity. He wants to see a congregational union of American synagogues. And so in 1841, he puts out a feeler to all the shuls on the Eastern Seaboard, are you willing to join in some kind of American Jewish congregational union? And there was positive reaction from many different synagogues, except Charleston. Why? Because Charleston, which was moving in the wrong direction, knew full well that Isaac Leizer is a traditional Jew and is not going to put up with the types of anti-halachic innovations that they are looking to pursue. In the end, this union did not come to pass. it would have to wait for a few more decades before you'd have a union. It would not be under his auspices. It would be under that of Isaac Meir Wise, who will be the topic of discussion for next week and the week after. Okay, these are attempts to establish the first ever American rabbinical school, the Maimonides College in Philadelphia in 1867. But he dies a year later, and Maimonides never really got off the ground. It had about 5 students at most, and never was anyone ordained. It fizzled out a few years after his death. But he tried his best. So he was a man of great accomplishment. But not everyone was listening to what he had to say, even in his own shul. In 1850, at the age of 44, he had to retire as chazan. Why? He got into a fight with the Kehillah. The elitist Spanish Portuguese Jews did not take kindly to Leiser's ideas. The one idea that he was successful in implementing was the sermon, the English language sermon. He came in 1829, and already in 1830 he begins to ascend the pulpit and give speeches on the parsha or some Judaic topic in English. For 13 years, he did it on sufferance, meaning he had to ask for permission every time, or periodically regain the confidence of the Parnassim, of the board, that it would allow him to ascend the rostrum to give a speech. Finally, in 1843, they passed new bylaws that said, the chazan is our lecturer, he can give a weekly sermon. And so he was able to do that for the next 7 years until the relationship fizzled out and he had to leave.
This is in Philadelphia.
After he was no longer Chazan, he was not tied down to Philadelphia, he went on a trip around the country in 1851, visiting many, many different Kehillot, all over along the Mississippi River, down into the south, and back up into the north. So he had a travel log. He knew much about American Judaism. He continued to publish The Occident.
Why did he pay for that?
Unclear. Well, he was a bachelor. So he wasn't supporting a family. There were accusations against him precisely because he was a bachelor. He was living in a boarding house run by a Gentile woman. And there were all sorts of accusations that he was fraternizing with her in ways he shouldn't. Or that he was eating non-kosher food. Let's assume that all this is lashon hara of the worst kind and none of it was true. It was said by his detractors just to ruin his reputation. But then in 1857, he becomes the chazan of Anshe Emeth, a competitor synagogue in Philadelphia, because he was no longer in good graces with Mikveh Israel.
Ashkenaz,
yes.
Was there many shuls off the East Coast?
Okay, so beginning in the 1820s, you do have shuls emerging off the East Coast. You have Cincinnati, St. Louis, eventually also Chicago, all the cities in Cleveland, Columbus, Reading, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh. Okay.
Where did the rabbis?
They didn't have rabbis. Okay, so let's now talk about the first rabbi. The first rabbi is Abraham Rice. Abraham Rice comes from Germany, where he couldn't have much of a career. It wasn't so easy to get Parnassa for a rabbi in those years. And he came from the yeshiva in Firth. He was Musmach of Rav Bing in Germany. And he comes to New York. Not intending to be a rabbi, but a position was offered to him in the Baltimore Hebrew congregation, so he takes it. But he is a traditionalist through and through, an Orthodox rabbi. And the people in Germany, in Baltimore, are moving further and further away from the tradition because of the demands of the economy. It's not so simple to be a Sabbath observer, or for that matter, even a kosher observer. And Abraham Rice tries to implement an exclusionary policy when it comes to the giving of aliyot. That you have to be Shomer Shabbos to get an aliyah. Oh boy. Shomer Shabbos. And the board says, no, you can't do that. So then he says, fine, the non-Shomer Shabbos Jew can get an aliyah, but the Olam should not say amen to the blessing. And then about 7 years after that, they said, no.
7 years it took?
Yes, yeah. this was an attempt at accommodating a non-traditional audience, yet still retaining some symbolic display of displeasure with the fact that you have to make an accommodation with a non-traditional audience. Yes. Yes. Okay. So
he took it out on the congregation.
In 1842, a breakaway forms because they're not happy with rice. It's called the Har Sinai Verein. A Verein meaning like a cultural group. And it eventually forms into a synagogue, an avowedly reformed synagogue. It's the first one after Charleston to establish itself as a non-Orthodox congregation.
You know what's the Bishakov today?
What?
The building.
The building, yeah? Har Sinai, yeah? So, Har Sinai, it's not all that radical in the beginning. The kinds of changes that they're going to implement are moderate early on. For example, English language sermon, abbreviated service, elimination of piyutim, over time, slowly less and less Hebrew and more English, although in the beginning German and then English. There's an evolution. First, the people who are recent immigrants have to learn the language before the vernacular is the vernacular of America. Separate seating until the 1860s. The first mixed seating is in Albany with Isaac Meir Wise. We're going to see that next week. So this Har Sinai established itself first as a Verein and then as a separate synagogue, and they're looking for leadership. Eventually, they will find leadership in David Einhorn. David Einhorn, the great ideologue of radical reform, who comes from Germany and then goes to Budapest temporarily in 1852 and then is out of work because as a very radical reform rabbi, it's hard to find work. So he comes to America and eventually makes his way to Baltimore. That's already in 1855, a little later in the game. So you have Rice as a traditionalist, the Har Sinai, the reformers moving rapidly in that direction. Rice, no one listens to him, even in his own shul. So he resigns in 1849, and he opens a dry goods store. That's what happens. The rabbi, the only rabbi in the country, and he can't make a go of it, because the people are not interested in listening to traditional rabbis. They were not so interested in listening to Isaac Leiser, who wasn't even a rabbi. He was just a chazan slash preacher. So the American Jews have an independent streak about them. And although they need religious leadership for the basic functions of conducting the service, they don't want to listen to them on the bigger issues. Let's now go to another character who shows up on the scene, Leo Merzbacher. Leo Merzbacher, you never heard of him. He's not famous. With good reason. Okay? He comes in 1842, and he claims to be a musmach of the Chassam Sofer, and to have a PhD from University of Munich. None of that is verifiable. It's probably bunk. All right, well, you're probably right. So he's not the first to claim credentials that were not really deserved, and he certainly would not be the last, not in America, and sure not. He comes to New York, and he is a fairly learned Jew in Talmudic studies, and so he's able to paskin shilas for Anshei Chesed and some of the other synagogues in New York. He ends up being hired by Emmanuel Congregation. Well, what is Emmanuel Congregation? Let's find out. So Temple Emmanuel, today the big house on 5th Avenue and 65th Street, began with fairly humble origins in 1845 as a Verein, and again, a cultural group that it morphs into a synagogue. They were not pleased with the existing German congregations because they wanted something that was moving away from tradition. Now, how far away from tradition? Not very far. But these people had aspirations to ascend the social ladder. They were not yet our crowd, but they would become our crowd within a few decades. They got rich very quickly. And the structure, the physical structure of Temple Emmanuel would clearly identify them as a wealthy shul. As they moved up from downtown to 12th Street to 43rd Street, eventually to 65th Street. each time building a bigger and better building. But in their humble beginnings, all they wanted was the German sermon, which eventually would morph into the English language sermon, some German language prayers, a shortened prayer service, the end of commercialism in the synagogue, decorum in the synagogue, and soon thereafter the abolition of the second day of Yom Tov. But it wasn't until 1864 that they abolish the yarmulke. And the abolition of the yarmulke is the turning point where we can say that Temple Emmanuel now represents real Reform Judaism, as opposed to being 100 years too early, but what was a 20th century version of conservative Judaism. Basically, from 1845 to 1864, the kinds of tinkering with tradition are the likes of which you would have seen in the United Synagogue of America congregation in 1950. So only with the abolition of the yarmulke do you have this departure from tradition, which is seen as wholly un-Jewish by more traditional folks.
Charleston gave rid of the yarmulke?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
What brought that on? What was the trend about the yarmulke?
The people were becoming acculturated, and very quickly. And they did not want to hold on to usages that look like it's from the old world. Simple as that. Nobody received aliyahs. Aliyahs were abolished. That's one of the important changes in 19th century Reform synagogues, is that you no longer have honorific roles in the service for the layperson. You have the professional clergy officiating at everything, including the reading of the Torah, so that you have someone reading the scroll, if it is out of a scroll, and no one is called up to say the Baruch Hu Hashem HaMavorach, because they're not interested in that. They want the people to sit passively while the professionals conduct the liturgy. No, the Torah? Torah was never read in English. Torah, if it's read at all, it's read in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
So bar mitzvah is replaced with confirmation. Confirmation, and the age of confirmation changes over time. In the beginning, it was just a plain old replacement for bar mitzvah at 13. Later, it would become 15 or even 16. Yeah.
What do they have today?
Today they have bar mitzvah. It's cool.
No, but today they have aliyahs.
Yes, the aliyahs were brought back.
In a manual,
aliyahs were brought back. Yes.
But for girls, for women too.
Of course, yeah. Without a doubt. Okay. So talesim were eliminated except for the clergy.
Yeah. Well, that was a costume.
It was a garb for the clergy. Okay. But Leo Merzbacher, in the beginning, he's posketing shilas for the traditional shuls, and Emmanuel hires him. But Emmanuel is very reluctant to give him any authority. He has to petition the board for the right to give kiddushin, to officiate at marriages. Now, in part, this was because there had been older officiants of marriages who didn't want to lose the parnassa, the money that they were getting for the conducting of life cycle occasions. But also, there's an element of control. The lay board does not want to create a powerful clergy position, so they don't. They simply refuse to give over to Merzbacher the kinds of authority that he wished he could have.
Okay, so Merzbacher was working for Emmanuel.
Yes.
But he was poskening for the Orthodox?
No. His early career was for the Orthodox, and then the latter years he went to Emmanuel.
Was he himself still traditional?
I don't know much about his private observance. There isn't much written about his life. other than when he died, it was a big funeral in 1856, and he wasn't a very old man. He was in his early 50s at the time and died suddenly. And his death led to the arrival of a major Reform theologian coming to America, because Emmanuel, now with ideas of how it's the major Reform synagogue of America, it has to have a great illustrious clergy person. They brought Samuel Hirsch, one of the leading Reform theologians from Europe, from Western Europe, to become the rabbi. Samuel Adler to become the rabbi of Emmanuel, not Samuel Hirsch, Samuel Adler. And Adler would be there until 1874 when he retired, to be replaced temporarily by Felix Adler, his son.
But he became
an atheist. And he became the founder of ethical culture. He survived one sermon at Temple Emmanuel, and they said, "Son, don't come back." He rejected God. So even in Emmanuel, you can't reject God. It's too reform. All right. So the next rabbi to show up on the scene, Max Lilienthal. Now, Max Lilienthal requires some explanation here. He's a German Jew who had legitimate smicha and a legitimate doctorate from a German university. At the age of 24, in 1839, he goes to Riga, Latvia, because there are stirrings of Haskalah in the Baltic countries. And in Riga, there's a community of enlightened Jews who don't just want the old-fashioned Orthodox service. So Lilienthal is a preacher / principal of a school. Then the Russian government gets a hold of him. They co-opt him. He was like the Carter Page of his time. So the Russian government has conversionary agendas for the Jews of the Pale. And they want to create schools where there are secular studies, Jewish schools with secular studies, where supposedly the agenda was just to make the Jews economically useful. Which, who could argue with that? Well, I mean, the traditional rabbis did argue even with that, but from a Maskilic point of view, as long as you're studying secular subjects and a little bit of Judaism for the sake of being, you know, good participants in society, then that's perfectly fine. But what they really intended was to convert people to the Russian Orthodox Church. So it took Lilienthal a long time to realize that the Romanov dynasty had a sinister agenda. It wasn't until 1845 that he got the message. He was booed out of Vilna, literally booed out of the shul and out of the town, because he was seen as a collaborator with a regime that's hostile to Judaism and looking to make people into goyim. So he leaves Europe kind of ignominiously and arrives in New York. Comes to New York. He's a legitimate rabbi, and we need rabbis here. So he becomes the chief rabbi of a conglomeration of the three of the Ashkenazi shuls. And he's poskening shilas, and even forms a Beis Din. Who's going to join him on the Beis Din? What other rabbonim exist to form a legitimate Beis Din? No, for what purpose, by the way? Mostly for gerushin, for divorce, for gittin. Not for conversion, nobody's converting to Judaism, and nobody has Choshen Mishpat questions of litigation, they want a Din Torah. It's mostly divorces, maybe a few other things, but mostly divorces. Who's going to serve with him? There are no other ordained rabbis.
Merzbacher is dead, right?
Merzbacher is alive, but he's on the reform element now. So learned lay people will serve with Lilienthal. Who are they? It doesn't matter who they are, but one person, it does matter. Isaac Meir Wise, who comes from Bohemia, from Radnitz, and he served temporarily on Lilienthal's Beis Din. But even Lilienthal ended up falling out of the good graces of the lay people, and they fired him in 1847. And he started a school. He was again the principal of a school until he's hired in Cincinnati by B'nai Israel in 1855. So we see time and time again that members of the clergy, whether duly ordained or not really ordained, they want to exercise a measure of authority in America, but they really can't. They really can't.
You talked about schools. What type of schools did these people try to form?
So there's an ongoing problem of how to train young people in Judaism. And there are basically three options. A lot, a little, and something in between. The a lot is a day school. But that requires staffing, you know, real teachers who know what they're talking about. It requires student body with parents interested in sending their kids to a school which is a parochial one at a time when Americanization is the ideal, what's being what they're striving for. So day schools typically don't survive much more than a year or two after their sort of pie-in-the-sky founders have this good idea. The minimal is the Sunday school, which was established by Rebecca Gratz in Philadelphia with the help of Isaac Leiser. which is a little bit weird because Leiser is a traditionalist and Rebecca Gratz most certainly wasn't. But it goes to show you that Leiser was willing to cooperate with people who were not so traditional if the goal was the preservation of Judaism. Unlike, let's say, late 20th century Orthodox groups that would ban participation in the Synagogue Council of America or ban participation in New York Board of Rabbis or any interdenominational cooperation, Leiser was not opposed to that as long as it was for a good cause. So that's like the minimal, the Sunday school. The in-between is the Talmud Torah, which afternoons and was popular in many communities. But how many years of instruction did an individual kid actually get? Not too many. Maybe, if you're lucky.
And they were run by the school.
They were run by either synagogues or independent of shuls by a Malamed who was looking to make a living. Someone it was a commercial enterprise for them. But the better synagogues established some type of school for their membership's children. Okay. So, in the 1840s, there are very few synagogues in America that are moving in the path of reform. You only have Har Sinai in Baltimore, Emmanuel in New York, Beth Elohim in Charleston, and that's pretty much it. But the trajectory is pretty clear. As immigrants are no longer greenhorns, but they're in the country for some length of time, they want a different style of synagogue. And so in the 1850s, you'll have more and more places develop into American synagogues with some degree of deviation from the halakha. What type of deviation? So an organ is a common one. Mixed seating, not yet, but soon to follow in the 1860s. The elimination of parts of the Hebrew service, which arguably is not anti-halakhic. Remember, in the Hamburg Temple controversy, there were good arguments made in favor of vernacular prayer. But here in America, those halakhic arguments held no weight. No one cared.
What about Shabbos?
Okay. So Shabbos has its own problems. People need to work. And in many of the communities, the question is, what do we do with the Sabbath desecrators in terms of participation in the service, being a member of the synagogue, being an elector in the synagogue, which is higher than just being a member, or even burial in a cemetery if you're not a devout Jew? Can you give him a burial plot? But all these questions end up being decided on the lenient side of things, because otherwise you'd have no kehillah. So necessity means lakula, leniency. Okay.
The reformists, was the whole system self-perpetuating in any way? For example, a hierarchy seemed to be saying there's a board.
Uh-huh.
But did they have a platform that they followed, or it was just a...
Okay. The truth of the matter is that sometimes, even when there was a bylaw that, for example, would say no changes can be made absent a vote of the full membership and a unanimous decision, those are like a holding pattern. You can create a bylaw that is designed to prevent reform agitation by requiring the overwhelming majority, but yet, once you have something of a majority, you change the bylaws. So, safeguards are attempted to prevent the slow, or sometimes fast, changeover from an Orthodox immigrant house of worship into an Americanized reform house of worship, but all these technical strategies fail. And what ends up happening to the traditionalists who are on the losing end of all that? What do?
Break away.
So they break away. Are they successful in establishing an alternative traditional house of worship? Usually not. The evidence suggests that when the main kehillah of a town goes from immigrant Ashkenazi Orthodox to Americanized moderate to radical reform, The breakaway traditionalists survive a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then there's nothing left. Why?
Because they're also
either because they don't have enough to sustain an infrastructure, or they too change their own viewpoint. Because maybe they're just a half a decade behind their neighbor in assimilation. And so everybody is marching in the same direction of assimilatory progress.
Well, it's more evolutionary because conferences as they had in Germany.
There were. Like that. So let's get to that now. I was going to save Isaac Meir Wise for next week, but let's start him now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a different environment altogether because you had a tremendous number of Eastern European Jews located in one place. Okay, so let's discuss Isaac Meir Wise. Born in 1819 in Bohemia, he has some secular education, some Jewish education, although not much of either one, but enough Jewish education to become a schoolhouse master, you know, a Malamed Tinokos in a Bohemian town, and to give sermons from the pulpit to an uneducated, Jewishly uneducated community. So he's not an ordained rabbi by any stretch, has no doctorate degree, probably never even went to university at all. Maybe he attended a few courses in the University of Prague. But he comes to America in 1846. And he has an idea that he's going to be the chief rabbi of America. The Jewish Pope, as David Einhorn would call him. So what does he do? Comes to New York. He participates with Lilienthal in the New York Beis Din, briefly. And then he, upon the recommendation of Lilienthal, is hired at a congregation in Anshe Emeth in Albany. Wise passes himself off as a traditionalist at first, a stickler for Shabbos observance, a believer in the divine revelation of the Torah, the Sinaitic revelation, which for him is very important. And by the way, he differs in that respect from many of the other Reformed theologians. For many of the Reformed theologians, what books of the Bible are the most important? The Nevi'im, the prophets. The prophetic tradition of Israel, the moral prophetic tradition of Israel. Not for Isaac Meir Wise. He wasn't so moral. No, Sinai. The revelation at Sinai for him is almost everything. Now, what is the revelation at Sinai? So for the traditionalists, it's the full Chamisha Chumshei Torah. For the less pious, it's only the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments. As Wise's career will move on over the years, he'll go from being a stickler for the Chamisha Chumshei Torah to just the Ten Commandments. But Sinai is opposed to the prophetic tradition. He does not implement too many changes at first because he doesn't want to rock the boat. But slowly but surely, in Albany, he's tinkering with the service. German language sermon. His English isn't good yet. Elimination of certain parts of the prayer, vernacular prayer, and he gets into a fight with the leadership. So they fire him. He shows up on Rosh Hashanah in 1850, having been removed from his position, in his clerical garb to lead the services. They take out the Torah for Ein Kamocha, Shacharis of Rosh Hashanah. And all of a sudden, the president of Shul Spanier, fist to the face, punches out the rabbi on the bima.
Holding the Torah?
I don't know if they dropped the Torah. I don't know. A fight breaks out. The police are called in. A big Chilul Hashem, a massive Chilul Hashem. Each side blames the other. Wise claimed he was just doing his job. The anti-Wise constituency said he was fired. He had no business being up on the pulpit. Who did he think he was? So a breakaway forms in Albany, and Wise is now the rabbi of this breakaway. They take over a church, and the church didn't have a balcony. So what does Wise do?
Mixed
seating. This is the first synagogue of mixed seating in the United States, 1850. Albany had a few shuls. Yeah, they had a lot of Jews.
What were Jews doing there?
Working for New York State. There was the Erie Canal. I mean, who knows? There was industry. There were jobs in Albany. Okay. To this day, there's a Jewish community in Albany, a fairly substantial one. So, for 4 years, 1850 to 1854, Wise is now the rabbi of a reform-oriented synagogue upstate New York. But he has great aspirations for himself. He wants to accomplish big things. In 1848, he called for a gathering of all the clergymen in America, the Jewish clergymen. The meeting never happened. Didn't happen. But if it did happen, he'd be in charge of it. Because he was convening it, that gives him the power to determine the agenda. So he learned this lesson very well. If you convene the conference, you determine what direction it heads. In 1854, he's hired by B'nai Jeshurun in Cincinnati. B'nai Jeshurun was a breakaway from B'nai Israel. It's Ashkenazi shul. It was founded in 1842, I believe. And not that large of a membership, but it's a growing community. And there's opportunity in Cincinnati. And Wise figures, if he gets away from the Eastern Seaboard, then the other religious figures, the leadership figures, will be far, far away from him. He could cultivate his own world in the Midwest, where he's the Jewish boss. And he was right. That's exactly how it worked out. There ended up being an East-West divide. Okay. So 18...
He said he didn't know much.
But he was a quick learner. He was able to read articles on a certain topic and then speak about it with great authority and fluency from the pulpit, whether Jewish or secular. So he passed himself off as a great intellectual, despite not really being one. And his theological positions were blowing in the wind. Whatever he thought was going to get him the greatest following, that's what he said at any given moment. The fact that he would contradict himself a decade later or 2 decades later is of no import.
Related to Stephen
Morris? No. Unrelated. So,
married?
Yes.
Wasn't the Reformed Hebrew Union college over there?
So he establishes it 20 years later. So 1854 he moves there. And one of the first things he does is establish a newspaper. But unlike Isaac Leeser's Occident, Isaac Meir Wise's paper, The Israelite, is going to be a weekly.
American.
Not yet. The Israelite. Not the American Israelite. He changes the name a decade later as part of his patriotic fervor. But in the beginning, The Israelite. 1854. In English. Now, why the Israelite? What? Why the name the Israelite? What could it have been called?
Jew.
It could have been called the Jewish Week. But it wasn't. It was called the Israelite.
Go back to the grand days.
Good. So Israelite is the commonly used word in Reform circles when you don't want to use the word Jew. The alternative is a member of the Mosaic faith. But that's too complicated. It's a mouthful. Israelite is a lot easier. Okay. So Hebrew and Israelite are nice, good, biblical terms that don't involve the word Jew. Jew is a dirty word. Okay. He has a German language publication that comes out starting a year later in 1855 called Die Deborah. The Deborah.
Deborah?
Deborah, yeah. Like the Shofetet, the Devorah.
But he also has the word the Deborah.
Also true. Why did he put out a German language publication and why was it called Die Deborah? Answer? Only the women read German. That was his claim. The men read the Israelite, the women will read the German. There was a certain sexist connotation to that whole issue, but he wanted to have mass readership of both genders. So you put out English, you put out German. What was in this publication? So first of all, his own material. Why? because he wants to spread his own reputation. It's not enough that he's the publisher or editor that his name appears in the box in the corner. He wants to propagandize his material to a constituency in the West and the South. Also, advertisements. What kind of advertisements?
Horowitz and Margret and Matzah.
That's years later in different publications. But what kind of advertisements? No. Jewish jobs. Now, why Jewish jobs? Because if you advertise both synagogues looking to hire and would-be clergymen looking to get hired, you make shiduchim, and you increase your influence around the Jewish world in America. Because if the Kehillah in the South owes the hiring of their clergymen to a contact made by Isaac Meir Wise, all of a sudden you have an allegiance to him, a debt of gratitude to him. He's your go-to man. All right. In 1855, Wise calls a meeting of all the big religious leaders. So who shows up? Isaac Leiser shows up. And so do many of the other lesser known clergymen. There aren't that many of them. Who doesn't show up is David Einhorn. He's right off the boat, just arrived in Baltimore, and needed time to settle down. But also, he wasn't interested in going to a meeting convened in Cleveland by some ignorant upstart out of Cincinnati. In the view of David Einhorn, who was a Eloi as a child in the European yeshiva, Isaac Meir Wise knew as much as a third grader. And he let him know it.
Where was Einhorn again?
Einhorn was the rabbi in Mecklenburg-Schwerin. Then he was the rabbi in Budapest. And then he came to Baltimore. But
he was educated
in... Who gave him smicha? I believe in the yeshiva in Firth. I think the Wurzburger Rav even might have given him a smicha. I'm not sure.
He was a bona fide learned man
who believed in a radical interpretation of Judaism.
He was most probably one of the most radical that came from
that ever was.
And he was from a traditional background.
Yes, absolutely.
He had his own prayer book. The Union prayer book was too religious.
Yeah, too religious. So in 1855, you have this meeting of the East and of the West. The East representing traditional, the West representing, at that point, moderate reform. They come up with a platform. The Bible is of immediate divine origin. Sounds pretty firm. And the Talmud is the logical exposition of the Bible. The binding logical exposition of the Bible. That's very traditional. It sounds like, you know, that you're accepting the Talmud and the Torah as the basis for continued Judaism. So Isaac Meir Wise was attacked viciously by the left, meaning by Einhorn, for capitulating to the theological demands of the traditionalists in order to gain their favor, that he should have held out and espoused the truly reform point of view. All right, the traditionalists, including Isaac Leiser, were attacked by some of the right-wingers for having sat in the same room as Isaac Meir Wise. So all parties on the extremes are attacking the middle for having collaborated with someone too far in the other direction. What came of this meeting? Next to nothing. What was supposed to come from this meeting? There was a desire by some to establish one prayer book for the United States. One Siddur, a custom, a rite for America. But who's going to put it together? Who's going to write the rite?
Minhag America.
Okay. So several different Siddurim came out in quick succession. In 1855... you have Avodat HaKodesh by Benjamin Zold. Not Benjamin Zold, by... I take it back. Not, that's 1865. First, 1856, you have Olat Tamid by Einhorn. 1857, you have Minhag America by Isaac Meir Wise. How do you spell America?
A-M-T-R-I-E.
Say that again.
K-A.
K-A. Minhag America with a K, not a C.
German spelling.
German spelling. Okay. So you have competing prayer books. In the late 1850s, about three or four different prayer books came out. But none of them were able to achieve a universal recognition because theological differences between each one. And also, you need to have a persona. You need to have to be recognized as a leader in order for your prayer book to achieve wide recognition.
Is this from the traditionalists or from the...
No, from the reformers. From the moderate to more extreme reform.
Traditionalists used the prayer book from Europe.
Correct. Or the Leeser translation, which was a traditional prayer book with English. Okay. So
these new prayer books, they had Hebrew on one side and English on the other.
Or German. So Minhag America was the most popular of all them because Isaac Meir Wise could sell it through his newspaper. You can make money through the sale of the prayer book. You advertise it in your own newspaper. And so throughout the South, there were kilot that used the Minhag America. It eventually would be replaced by the Union Prayer Book in the 1890s, which would become acceptable in almost all the Reform houses of worship. But that's way ahead. So they're writing prayer books, each one competing with the other. 1855 Cleveland Conference, a traditional declaration, makes the reformers not very happy. East versus West, radical versus moderate. Another thing Isaac Meir Wise wants, to make a rabbinical seminary. American Jewry has to train its own rabbis. We should not be reliant upon arrivals from Europe. Now here, Wise is also self-serving, because the arrivals from Europe, especially if they're truly ordained rabbis, know a whole lot more than he does, and have the credentials, the legitimate credentials. So what's the solution to that problem? You become not the musmach, but the masmich, the person who's giving the credentials, by establishing a rabbinical seminary in your name. And then, nobody knows more than you do, because you were the teacher.
Nobody recognized that he didn't know the
one. Didn't matter. People didn't care. Okay. As long as he's one step ahead of the laity, that's all that matters. Okay, so he establishes Zion College. You never heard of Zion College. Didn't last very long. He established chapters for the Zion Collegiate Association all around the United States, hoping to solicit funds to build this seminary, and it would have to be in Cincinnati. Why Cincinnati? Because he's there, but why does he say it has to be in Cincinnati? He can't just say, I want to be the boss of everything, it has to be in my town. He has to come up with some plausible justification for why it's in Cincinnati.
Midway between East and West.
Okay, it's a convenient midpoint between the East and the North and the South and the West. You can get there very quickly. It's in the middle. All right, that's his excuse. But he doesn't follow up with the promises that he made to the various Zion College chapters around the country when he collected their money. He was supposed to wait and not establish a school or not operate a school until there was an endowment and there was a board of governors and agreement about what this school would be, whether it would be a preparatory school, be a graduate level school. None of that had been resolved. But instead, he just opens it up in the fall of 1855. With about 14 students, from half of them from Cincinnati, others from other parts of the Midwest, 13 boys and one girl. But it wasn't a rabbinical training school; it was really just a high school. It was a cheder with mostly secular studies and some Jewish studies, and it lasted a grand total of a year and a half. It fizzled out. So he had this big idea, but he couldn't pull it off yet. So what do we see thus far? He tried to have a meeting of congregations, a meeting of clergy. He successfully had a newspaper. He tried to have a rabbinical school, failure. But all the things that he wanted to accomplish early on that didn't work out, he will try again later on when there is a larger number of Jews in the country and there's a critical mass to achieve these things, and he'll be successful. So next week, we'll talk about his successes later in his career, but more importantly, what is the direction of the American synagogue? If in 1850, there were only a handful of Reform synagogues, by 1870, there were only a handful of Orthodox synagogues. How did that happen?
Assimilation.
To a great measure, acculturation. The Civil War plays an important role. Also, immigration patterns play an important role. So we'll stop here. Next time, we'll continue with the Civil War era.